Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Friday, November 16th, 2012. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. Organizers of a major effort to aid the homeless in Sitka last winter are hoping to repeat their success this coming January. The nonprofit Easter Group spearheaded a multi-agency collaboration to provide basic services to Sitka's homeless called Project Homeless Connect. Over 45 individuals attended the event in Harrigan Centennial Hall, an unexpectedly high turnout that caught the attention of municipal government and the public alike. The 2013 Project Homeless Connect begins with a planning summit next Monday at Harrigan Centennial Hall. Robert Woolsey reports.
Dory Farrell and Julia Smith both volunteer for the Easter Group. Smith says she first became aware of homelessness in Sitka when she was the administrator of the Pioneer Home.
People move in because they're homeless, and then we'd have visitors who were homeless. And I would see those folks on the street and think, gosh, I wouldn't have had a clue.
Smith says the relative invisibility of homelessness compared to a large city like Seattle makes it a challenging problem to address.
The people who need housing and who don't have a place to live may be someone that you see every day and you don't have any idea that they need that help.
Monday's summit will be organized into three panels. The first is the immediate crisis responders. Dory Farrell says you'll find the obvious agencies here, the fire department, the police, the Salvation Army, SAFE, but also the not so obvious.
One person who does a great deal in town with no official capacity is Sarah Bell at the library. She constantly and kindly handles the people who come into the library to get warm, to use the computers, to use the restrooms. And she's so very judicious and fair to them.
The organizations on the intermediate and long-term solutions panel include Youth Advocates of Sitka, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Sitka Tribe, Alaska Public Assistance, the Baranoff Island Housing Authority, and the Legislative Information Office. A healthcare panel will include search and public health. This is a lot of manpower in support of the homeless, but Farrell says it's not always easy coordinating efforts. An agency might direct someone to the right place.
But the people they're trying to direct don't have cars, and they don't have warm clothes, and they don't know where to go. So it's important that the agencies discuss what they can do, what they can't do, what their limitations are.
Farrell and Smith say the public is welcome to sit in on Monday's planning summit, if only to get an idea of the scale of the problem. Both agree that Project Homeless Connect remains only an interim solution for a problem that is not going away anytime soon. Smith says the next step is to explore funding for a family transitional center or a drop-in shelter.
Sometimes giving someone quick shelter is absolutely necessary, but to help somebody make it through and get back on their feet, you need something in transition. And so those two things kind of go together in my mind, and we at the Easter Group are really interested in working toward this. And, of course, we can't do it alone. We need partners. So that's the kind of thing we are kind of thinking about with the summit event.
Monday's summit will also include a mini Homeless Connect for 2 hours from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Smith says many event participants last January thought autumn was a more critical time to assist the homeless. The mini event will offer 6 of the top services provided last January. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Decent weather this fall has helped divers harvest sea cucumbers and gooey duck clams from the seafloor in southeast Alaska. One of the dive fisheries is wrapping up this month, while the other should continue through the winter. Joe Vicknicki reports.
The sea cucumber fishery started up October 1st with a guideline harvest level of 1.5 million pounds. Divers had landed most of that by mid-November. Phil Doherty is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association. That's an industry group based in Ketchikan.
The good thing about the sea cucumber fishery so far is the divers have all been safe. We've actually had some pretty good weather during most of our openings in October, as I'm sure you realize that. So, no, it's been a good season for sea cucumbers.
The slow-moving, bottom-feeding sea creatures are shaped like their vegetable namesakes, and they're sold in Asian markets. They've fetched a strong price this year and saw good interest from the fleet in the early part of the season. Jan Rumble, Southeast Dive Fisheries Research Project Leader for Fish and Game, lists some of the numbers from this fall's fishery.
The harvest by week has steadily decreased from about 300,000 the first week to 61,000 pounds this past opening. The average price per pound for sea cucumbers was about $4, which is the second highest on record. And the participation by the divers dropped off during the season as well. 192 divers in the first opening, decreasing to 63 divers during the November 5th opening.
The guideline harvest levels for the various areas of Southeast are set based on stock assessment diving done by Fish and Game each summer. The department continues to report reduced numbers of cucumbers in some areas due to sea otter predation, and some areas did not open to fishing because of low numbers. The fleet had caught most of the overall guideline harvest level by the second week in November, and only a few areas remain open to fishing. Meanwhile, diving for geoduck clams opened up October 1st, with fishing one day a week in areas mostly around Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island. The overall guideline harvest level for the large clams this year is 743,000 pounds. Fish and Game estimates the fleet had landed about 320,000 pounds by November 9th. Most of the 38 geoduck fishery areas in the region are opened on a two-year cycle, and clam stocks have also been impacted by sea otters. Fish and Game determines weekly openings of the various areas around the region based on results of testing clam samples for paralytic shellfish poisoning conducted by the state's Department of Environmental Conservation. Fish and Game's Rumble says geoduck prices started out about $6 a pound this season, but dropped to $3 a pound this month.
Worries that too much product was on the market, and then that was driving down the price. Industry tried to slow down the fishery, so they worked with us to slow it down and imposed trip limits to try to decrease the total harvest by week so they weren't flooding the market with geoducks. This was effective in reducing the harvest. The first week harvest was 70,000 pounds, and the most recent harvest was 35,000 pounds, and that's what industry wanted.
The fishery had a 700-pound trip limit in place in November, and Sardfa's Doherty says that seems to be helping with the price.
The market seems to have been able to absorb that smaller amount of geoducks at a better rate, and the prices seem to be going up. Right now, divers have been between $5 and $6 a pound. We'll hope to get that up a little bit more toward $8, if not $10 a pound before the season's over.
Current prices are still well below what the fleet saw last year. Doherty says geoducks fetched about $15 a pound for a few weeks, and some clams sold for about $20 a pound last year. He says this year buyers in China have been a little bit more fickle, with a glut of clams from Washington State and British Columbia competing with Southeast Alaska's catch. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Senate Republicans are vowing to continue a moratorium on earmarks this coming Congress. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it could have repercussions in Alaska, a state that relies heavily on federal funding.
Both chambers of Congress adopted a two-year ban on congressionally directed spending for the current session that's winding down. Earmarks, the pet projects of lawmakers that the federal government picks up the tab for, came under scrutiny because of projects like a would-be bridge between Gravina and Ketchikan. Dubbed the Bridge to Nowhere, it became the poster child of runaway spending. And since then, lawmakers in both parties have railed against them. But veteran appropriators like U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski say the approach is misguided.
We have taken an approach that I think is designed to be more of a public relations thing. You got to convince the public that we're cutting the budget. We're not cutting spending. We're letting the executive branch determine the priorities.
Senator Murkowski says she voted no Wednesday when her party put the earmark ban up for consideration in a closed-door meeting. Senate Democrats have yet to decide whether to reinstate earmarks. Senator Mark Begich's assessment of the Republicans' move?
That's too bad.
Senator Begich says he'll work to remove the ban because the spending is essential to infrastructure projects in the state. Though he says with shrinking federal coffers, Alaska needs to pony up its share for projects like improvements to the Seward Highway.
You look at that need on that road, the safety hazard it is, it's going to take a lot of money, and the state has to put a little more on the table than they have in the past.
Earmarks rarely account for more than 1% of the overall federal budget. Most spending goes to entitlement programs and the Defense Department. All of those, including Medicare and Medicaid, will come under scrutiny in the coming debate on corralling the federal deficit. Alaska receives more federal aid than any other state, more than twice the U.S. average in 2010. The state is also richer than it's ever been before, says Juno economist Greg Erickson. And despite the state's financial health, The permanent fund is worth $42 billion, and the state operates in the black. Local issues cannot always get the money they need, so earmarks remain important.
Well, they're a very big deal for the village that is seeing its coastline destroyed and that needs maybe $20,000 per resident to move that village to some place where it can be sustained. A very big deal, because that's probably not going to be a project that's going to garner the kind of support to be funded in the normal course of things.
Whether or not both parties in both houses of Congress opt to reinstate earmarking, the state will continue to receive billions of dollars in federal money for the military, health care, and transportation. Some local projects, though, may be more difficult to fund than others. And it's up to the congressional delegation to prove to their colleagues that it's worth the taxpayers' dime. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
An unattended candle likely caused last week's fire at Gastineau Apartments in downtown Juneau. Fire Marshal Dan Jager says an investigation determined the blaze started in the bedroom of an apartment on the fourth floor in the back corner of the building.
We know that the fire occurred on the floor in close proximity of a bed that was in there. This was all verified by the occupant who had come home and found the fire. We can't pin down that it was an unattended candle, but after eliminating all the other potentials, that's the only possible heat source that we can find where the fire had started.
Jager declined to name the person who lived in the apartment because he does not expect any criminal charges or citations. He and Fire Chief Rich Etheridge spent most of Monday assisting three insurance companies with their investigations.
They did a walk through the building to see overall how the damage was and took their own photographs, took notes. They'll be doing their own interviews with occupants. A lot of it's stuff that we've already done, but it's them doing their own independent investigation.
The building itself was insured along with two businesses on the ground floor. Jager also believes that some tenants may have had renter's insurance.